Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today we're reading from the May 16th, 2025 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week looks like a toy store or maybe the toy department in a big department store. We see a big rack of metal shelving with just almost empty, just a few random toys. In the foreground is a character that looks like the cartoon character, the Grinch. He's got on a red tie. He's wearing a Make America Great Again hat. He's got a diabolical smile on his face as he fills up a huge red bag with the toys. The headline is Stealing Christmas. Trump says Americans will shrug off the shortages caused by his tariffs. Is he right? We'll see that on the Controversy of the Week. The first main story is on U.S.-China tariff talks, but I believe we'll do the two shorter main stories on the next page. First up is Israel announces indefinite reoccupation of Gaza. What happened? Israel announced a major escalation of war in Gaza this week, approving a plan to reoccupy the territory and relocate most of the 2 million Palestinians who live there. The Israeli Defense Forces began calling up tens of thousands of reservists for the offensive, which is set to start next week, after President Trump visits Saudi Arabia, unless a deal is reached with Hamas to release the remaining 24 living hostages. The plan calls for the IDF to set up sterile zones to confine the Gaza population while the military combs the territory for Hamas fighters and demolishes their tunnels. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the occupation would last indefinitely. Gaza will be totally destroyed, said Israeli Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, and its people will leave in great numbers to third countries. The humanitarian situation in the territory is already catastrophic because of the total Israeli aid blockade in place since March. Israel has continued pounding the region with airstrikes, killing dozens more people this week. It also bombed sites in Yemen in retaliation for a missile strike by the Iranian-backed Houthi militia that hit a Tel Aviv airport. President Trump said the U.S. would end its own bombing campaign against the Houthis, intended to stop the Yemeni fighters from targeting international shipping in the Red Sea because they had given up. They said, please don't bomb us anymore, and we're not going to attack your ships, Trump said. The Houthis, though, said the ceasefire did not extend to Israeli ships. What the columnist said. Trump's extrication of the U.S. from its tangle with the Houthis is a welcome reprieve, said Robert F. Worth in The Atlantic. But the militia remains a potent menace in the Gulf. While Oman, whose negotiators mediated the truce, insists that international shipping is now secure, Israel will still be targeted. And it's not clear that other U.S. allies are safe either. This is what America First foreign policy looks like. Trump had less success with his calls for Israel to allow aid into Gaza, said Sean Carroll in the New York Times. The group I head, American Near East Refugee Aid, is on the ground there, and we've seen how food, fuel, and medicine are exhausted or close to it, with families reduced to a single meal every 2 or 3 days. Israeli officials have openly said they intend to use starvation as a tactic to pressure Hamas to release the remaining hostages. Already, children are dying of hunger. Yet Israel is no closer to getting the hostages because Netanyahu is unabashedly prioritizing war over their safety, said Jeremy Dimon in CNN.com. with Hamas threatening to execute hostages if the IDF closes in on its positions, most Israelis want a ceasefire in exchange for a full hostage release. But far-right cabinet ministers have threatened to topple the government if Netanyahu agrees to such a deal, and he has chosen his own political survival. For the people of Gaza, this new offensive will bring another mass force displacement and more death and destruction. GOP impasse over a big, beautiful budget bill. What happened? House Republicans this week voiced doubt they could pass a massive domestic policy bill before Memorial Day, as GOP moderates and fiscal hawks clashed over spending cuts, safety net program overhauls, and tax reforms. Republican lawmakers settled on measures that would increase national security spending by $350 billion, but have found themselves at loggerheads on offsetting cuts. A House committee agreed to raise money through oil and gas leases on public land sales, but House Speaker Mike Johnson retreated from a plan to reduce federal Medicaid payments after a dozen moderates rebelled. Blue state representatives also insisted on lifting the cap on deductions for state and local taxes. GOP lawmakers haggled over how to fit in President Trump's promises to extend the 2017 tax cuts and introduce tax breaks on overtime, tips, and Social Security benefits. Senator Bernie Moreno, Republican from Ohio, insisted that only delivering on Trump's tax promises mattered, not the current sandstorm of bad ideas. Republicans now say they plan to have the budget bill passed by both the House and Senate by July 4th, weeks before some analysts believe the U.S. could exhaust its borrowing authority. The national debt currently stands at $36 trillion, and the Institute of International Finance warned that extending Trump's tax cuts would put the U.S. on an alarming trajectory that could send interest rates soaring and scare away global investors. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent insisted cuts would be offset by long-term tariff revenue. What the columnist said: Trump's big, beautiful bill could become a GOP albatross, said Chris Layman in The Nation. It's stuffed with right-wing wish list items like a $1 trillion boost for the Pentagon, while allowing $880 billion of the $1.5 trillion in plan cuts to fall on Medicaid. And Republicans still can't come together because House Freedom Caucus hardliners are signaling a showdown over anything that increases net spending. By backing down on substantial cuts, Republicans are wasting a generational opportunity for Medicaid reform, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Thanks to Obamacare rules, states that expanded Medicaid can sit back and let the federal government pay 90% of the cost of covering prime-age adults. That's more than Washington pays for pregnant women and disabled Americans, the very people Medicaid was meant for. Republicans may not get another opening to fix this. The real main drivers of debt are Medicare, Social Security, and defense spending, and few Republicans are willing to cut those, said Russell Berman in The Atlantic. That means we are headed for trouble. Extending Trump's 2017 tax cuts would add an estimated $5 trillion to the national debt. Previous doomsday predictions about growing at well past 100% of the size of our GDP have not been realized, which has produced an unspoken bipartisan understanding that the risks are minimal. But Trump's proposals could shatter that assumption. Controversy of the week. $2. Can Trump sell Americans on austerity? There may not be much under the tree for America's children this Christmas, said Chris Saliza in his Substack newsletter. But Donald Trump just handed Democrats a huge gift. In last week's televised cabinet meeting, the president shrugged off concerns that his trade war with China could lead to higher prices and empty shelves. Well, maybe the children will have $2 instead of $30, you know, he told reporters. And maybe the $2 will cost a couple of bucks more. Not since Dr. Seuss Grinch had a strangely hued public figure been so upbeat about the prospect of children going without toys. And with millions of average Americans already struggling to meet their basic needs, it would be campaign malpractice for Democrats not to run this out-of-touch soundbite on a loop. Trump even obliged them with a second take, telling NBC News Kristen Welker, the kids also don't need to have 250 pencils. They can have five. So much for Trump's campaign trail promise of abundance, said Dan McLaughlin in National Review. This sudden embrace of austerity echoes President Jimmy Carter's 1979 infamous malaise speech that preceded Ronald Reagan's 1980 landslide. If Trump's best defense of tariffs is really suck it up and buy less stuff for your kids this Christmas, Republicans are headed to a Carter-sized catastrophe. It's hard to put a positive spin on price hikes and empty shelves, said Rebecca Onion in Slate. Yet Trump's framing of his disastrous tariffs as a chance for American children to appreciate fewer playthings of higher quality is a masterpiece of political messaging. For countless parents who find their homes swamped by stuffies and fragile plastic toys, his $2 line is a hit. Yes, the toy industry will suffer because of tariffs. China makes 80% of toys sold in the U.S., but my guilt about overconsumption may be eased. Trump is channeling an old-fashioned, morally vigorous philosophy that sustained previous generations of Americans through hard times, said Peter Tongett in The American Conservative. It does you good to do without. It depends on why times are hard, said Matthew Hennessy in The Wall Street Journal. Americans will happily scrimp and save in the event of a real emergency, be it a war or a natural disaster. But this isn't a real emergency. We're being asked to tighten our belts purely because of Trump's own policy decisions and his stubborn insistence on sticking with them, which is why his approval rating on the economy is now underwater by double digits. And since when do Republicans peddle this socialistic scarcity mindset? Asked Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch. Trump's $2 remark could have been lifted from one of Senator Bernie Sanders' moralistic lectures about consumerism, except that Bernie would have framed it more tactfully. Perhaps Americans should cut back on cheap imported plastic goods, said David A. Graham in The Atlantic. But Trump is a particularly flawed messenger for that idea. From his literal gilded mansion to a career spent hawking branded steaks, neckties, and condos, he is the walking embodiment of shallow materialism. What's especially grating, said Joe Berkowitz in Fast Company, is that the president is pushing austerity as his own family rakes in billions from dubious crypto schemes and he seeks to extend tax cuts for the super rich. This new embrace of American sacrifice would be easier to swallow, in short, if it weren't coming from a billionaire who thinks other billionaires deserve more billions. So, good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for pretty much everyone. After Attorney General Pam Bondi praised President Trump's vigorous action to keep fentanyl out of America for having saved 258 million lives in the first 100 days of his second term. That figure was a 117% increase over the 119 million lives Bondi had credited Trump with saving only a day earlier. It's a good week for passion. After Columbia University researchers concluded that celiac sufferers can safely kiss, even deeply, with tongue, people who just ate bread or other gluten-containing food. Only a trivial amount of gluten, they found, is transferred from mouth to mouth in a French kiss. It was a good week for alternative facts. after Trump Media's newly launched streaming service, Truth Plus, quickly filled up with conspiracy-heavy content. One popular film on the platform claims Jesus and Buddha were aliens. Another, Lizard People, suggests a race of reptilian space beings created humans. But it was a bad week for hospitality. After the Trump administration warned foreign soccer fans not to overstay their visas if they attend next year's World Cup in the U.S. When the time is up, they'll have to go home, said Vice President J.D. Vance. Otherwise, they'll have to talk to Homeland Security Secretary Kristen Noem. It's a bad week for grooming after CNN reported that Manosphere influencers are advising young men to shave their eyelashes to appear more masculine. British eye surgeon Vicky Lee cautioned that eyelashes are vital for both visual experience and eye health. Finally, it was a bad week for belt tightening after Trump defended his plan to have taxpayers fund a lavish military parade in Washington, D.C. to mark the Army's 250th birthday on June 14th, which is also his own birthday. The parade's estimated $45 million price tag, he said, is peanuts compared to the value. And a short and other news piece. Supreme Court reinstates ban on transgender troops. The Supreme Court ruled this week that the Trump administration can enforce its ban on transgender troops in the military, overturning a lower court's order. The High Court's three liberal justices dissented to the unsigned ruling, which will remain in place while litigation continues. President Trump issued an executive order barring transgender people from serving in the military on his first day in office, reversing a Biden-era policy allowing them to serve openly. The Defense Department implemented the order in February, but a group of active service members, a person looking to enlist, and an advocacy group sued, arguing the order violated the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause. Federal judge blocked the ban in March, ruling it was not needed for unit cohesion, good order, or discipline. About 4,200 members of the military identify as transgender, according to the Defense Department. The subject for this week's briefing is Unraveling Autism. RFK Jr. has vowed to find the root cause of the autism epidemic in months. Scientists have doubts. Is the government studying autism? Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. last month launched a massive testing and research effort that he says by September will reveal the mystery of what causes autism and what is behind a surge in diagnosed cases. Kennedy, who has for years promoted the discredited claim that vaccines cause autism, didn't mention childhood shots when announcing the study. But he proclaimed a certainty that an environmental toxin is behind rising case numbers, and said scientists will look at food additives, mold, pesticides, medicines, ultrasound, scanning, and other potential factors. This is a preventable disease, Kennedy said. We know that it's an environmental exposure. Experts say his claims are deeply flawed. The overwhelming majority don't believe that autism, a neurological and development disorder with a range of symptoms that typically include impaired communication and social skills, is caused by environmental factors. And while autism rates are trending higher, it seems very unlikely that it is an epidemic in the way that people define epidemics, said Catherine Lord, an autism researcher at the University of California, Los Angeles. Have rates climbed significantly? Autism incidence in the U.S. has gone from 1 in 150 children in 2000 to 1-54 in 2016 to 1-31 in 2022, according to the CDC. But experts believe much or all of this rise is due to improved diagnosis and a broadening of the criteria for who qualifies as autistic. There's no blood test or brain scan that can detect autism spectrum disorder. Diagnoses come through observation, with universal screenings recommended since the 1990s for 18 and 24 months. Experts say clinicians and parents have become better attuned to symptoms, and that cases that once would have been labeled as mental retardation and language disorders are now falling under ASD. "You're capturing more subtle presentations," said Roma Vassa, a psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. "There is evidence to back this up. Severe cases involving nonverbal children, which are easily diagnosed, have held steady. And there's been a disproportionate rise in cases among Black and Latino children, which could correlate with improved access to diagnostic services. But exactly what causes autism is not yet clear." What do we know? Scientists say the primary cause of autism is genetic, with environmental factors playing a secondary role. Powerful evidence of this can be seen in studies of twins. In identical twins who share all their DNA, if one twin has ASD, the other typically does as well. And in fraternal twins who share about half their DNA, if one twin has autism, the chance the other will also ranges from 53% to 67%, according to a review of studies. Researchers have identified more than 250 genes associated with elevated odds of ASD and linked most autism cases, about 80%, to inherited genetic mutations and at least another 10% to non-inherited mutations. While autism generally surfaces during toddlerhood, experts believe it is established in the earliest stages of brain development in the womb, said Maddie Hornig, an epidemiologist at Columbia University. It's possible that environmental factors may play a contributory role in utero. What types of factors? Numerous studies have linked maternal exposure to air pollution, especially late in pregnancy, with higher risk of an autistic child. It's suspected that ultra-small particles of fossil fuel pollution may trigger biological cascades that affect brain development, and that individuals with a genetic predisposition to autism are more vulnerable to those harmful effects. Researchers have examined other toxins. A UCLA study found that pregnant mothers who live near farms that spray commonly used pesticides were up to 16% more likely to have children diagnosed with autism than those who live further away. Vitamin deficiencies could also play a role. Several studies have noted a lowered autism risk among pregnant mothers who took folic acid or vitamin B9. In a 2013 Norwegian study, the drop was almost 40%. Scientists have also drawn connections between autism and certain physiological risk factors in parents. How strong are those links? There seems to be a powerful correlation between autism and paternal age, especially among children born to older fathers. An Israeli study found that children fathered by men in their 40s or older were 6 times more likely to have autism or related disorders than those fathered by men younger than 30. Preterm births may also be a predictor for autism. A study of 4 million births in Sweden found that a child born between 28 and 33 weeks is about twice as likely to be diagnosed with autism than one born at full term, and that those born between 22 and 27 weeks are 4 times as likely to be diagnosed. Meanwhile, a study of Swiss mothers showed that those who'd been hospitalized for an infection during pregnancy were 37% more likely to have a child with autism. All these findings indicate autism is an extraordinarily complex condition, said Hornig, probably influenced by hundreds of genetic, environmental, behavioral, and dietary factors. Might RFK Jr.'s study shed any light? Odds are low at best, say scientists. Properly conducted, such an effort would require years, not months. And the study's premise, that a sole environmental cause can be found and eliminated, refutes everything known to date about autism. We're dealing with the complexity of the formation of the human brain, said Janine LaSalle, professor of microbiology and immunity at University of California, Davis. If there were a single smoking gun, it would have been found by now. An enduring myth. More than a dozen major studies involving hundreds of thousands of children across three continents have proved comprehensively that vaccines do not cause autism. But the idea of a link between childhood shots and autism, and particularly the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, has showed dogged staying power. A recent Gallup poll survey found 13% of Americans believe in the connection, and half were unsure. The fears over MMR date to 1998, when British doctor Andrew Wakefield published an article in The Lancet tying vaccines to autism in a dozen children he studied. Scores of problems were found with the study, which was retracted by the journal, but the cage door got open and the devil came out, said vaccine expert Paul Offit. Scientists note several reasons the debunked theory has such legs, including that the first MMR dose is given between 12 and 15 months, around the time autism typically emerges. And blaming vaccines for causing autism gives parents a simple explanation for a condition that continues to puzzle scientists. Whatever the cause is, said UCLA autism researcher Lord, it's not vaccines. Time for a few of the best columns. Start with Trump admits migrant can be returned. President Trump has managed to badly sabotage his own legal argument for not bringing Kilmar Abrego Garcia back to the U.S., said Greg Sargent. For weeks, Trump and other administration officials pretended they could not retrieve the undocumented migrant from a harsh prison in El Salvador, where he was sent without a hearing in March in violation of a previous court order. But Trump admitted in interviews over the last week that he could just pick up the phone and ask El Salvador to return Abrego Garcia. It's just that we have lawyers who don't want to do this. That admission will no doubt interest federal judge Paula Zenas, who has ordered the administration to explain why it defied her order to facilitate Abrego Garcia's return, an order the Supreme Court upheld, 9-0. Justice Department lawyers don't dictate policy, so they are very likely being told what to do by Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller, a rabid anti-immigration zealot who insists that Trump should have unlimited power to expel all illegal aliens without any hearings. With Miller egging Trump on, this administration's deportation policies are lawless, arbitrary, and dictatorial. Proudly so. Fetterman's mental health struggles. Several of Senator John Fetterman's current and former staffers say the Pennsylvania Democrat's mental health has deteriorated and are questioning his fitness to be a senator, said Ben Terrace. A gruff 6'8" advocate for the working class, Fetterman gained national prominence when he ran for the Senate. He won despite suffering a stroke during the campaign that limits his ability to process spoken words. After getting psychiatric help for emotional problems related to the stroke, he had an energetic start in office. But staffers say he soon stopped taking medication and consulting with his doctors, and his behavior became bizarre. Fetterman was alternately manic and deeply withdrawn, and has been videoed yelling at a constituent and arguing with airline staff about wearing a seatbelt. His chief of staff, Adam Jettelson, resigned in 2024, and wrote to Fetterman's doctors, saying the senator has become a risk to himself and others. Weeks later, Fetterman crashed his speeding car into the back of another, badly injuring his wife. Fetterman, who now misses many Senate votes, says disgruntled employees are lying about its condition. But Gentleson says his former boss is struggling in a way that shouldn't be hidden from the public. This column comes from Denmark. Welcome to the surveillance state, said Mikkel Ninandam. Danes are already watched everywhere we go, with more than 1.5 million security cameras trained on the doings of just 6 million inhabitants. The police use a platform called Gotham, developed by Palantir, a company with ties to the Trump administration, that scours local and international databases. The technology helps them prevent crime through so-called predictive policing, in which algorithms identify possible future perpetrators and hotspots for crime. The names alone are creepy. Palantir after Tolkien's magical and corrupting crystal ball, Gotham after the crime-ridden authoritarian city in the Batman universe. Now it's about to get even worse. A new bill would let police sift through data from the healthcare system, social services, and other public sources so they can profile citizens without specific suspicion of crime. This is scary stuff. Yes, the state needs to protect citizens from crime, but when it gains access to such intimate and extensive data without the need for a court order or transparency, we're heading toward a dark place. It would be a fundamental change in Dane's relationship to the state. When surveillance becomes automated, covert, and permanent, it's not being used to protect us, but to control us. Do we really want to be a society where every citizen is a suspect by default? And the last word, our in-depth article, disappearing into Russia's abyss. A Ukrainian journalist tried to expose Russia's brutal detention system, said Kate Brown in the Washington Post. She ended up dying in its most notorious prison. Victoria Roschina set out to report on claims that Russia was operating a network of unofficial detention centers in occupied Ukraine. But in August 2023, she disappeared into one herself. For months, her whereabouts remained unknown. The body bag was delivered to Kyiv on a flatbed truck. There was an alphanumeric code stamped across the white shroud, followed by four Cyrillic letters, C-I-A-C. A Russian abbreviation denoting extensive damage to the coronary arteries. For most of the 757 Ukrainian bodies exchanged for Russian dead on February 14th, the Russian authorities had provided their counterparts in Kyiv with names of the deceased, nearly all male soldiers, and the dates they were killed. The final entry on the list, handed to the prosecutors, only said unidentified male. When forensic experts opened the bag, they found a female body. Her head was shaved, her neck bruised. There was a tag with her last name attached to one shin, burn marks on her feet, according to officials familiar with an ongoing investigation by Ukrainian Prosecutor General's office. Medical examiners later found a broken rib and possible traces of electric shock. Some of her organs, including her brain, had been removed, officials said. A DNA test confirmed that the body belonged to Victoria Roschina, a 27-year-old Ukrainian journalist who had disappeared into the Russian prison system after being detained while reporting in the occupied territories in August 2023. Roschina, the first Ukrainian journalist to die in Russian captivity, was reported dead in a curt note dated October 2nd and addressed by Russian authorities to her father, Volodymyr Roschin. But without any details on the cause of death, Her father clung to hope she might still be alive. Before one of her last reporting trips, Rushton recalled his daughter had carried a bulletproof vest and a pierced helmet into his home. He asked her to stay, but remembers only that she said, "I have to go." Rushchina had spent most of her time in custody in the Taranrog SIZO-2 in southern Russia, a key facility in a constellation of Russian prisons and an ad hoc detention sites where thousands of Ukrainian civilians have been incarcerated over the course of the war. Many, like Rushchina, have been detained without charges and held incommunicado for months. For much of the war, the former juvenile detention center at Taranrog has been a site of systematic physical and psychological abuse. The treatment of detained Ukrainian civilians is one of the most brutal and least examined parts of the Kremlin's prosecution of the war. Rushchina wanted to expose this heavily camouflaged penal system until her own disappearance and unexplained death became an emblem of Russia's violation of the laws of war. Officials, activists, and lawyers said, with a prison at Taranrog just over the border from occupied Ukraine as exhibit number one. A coalition of 45 international journalists led by Paris-based Forbidden Stories and including the Washington Post has continued Rushchina's work and conducted a months-long investigation into her death. The Taranrog complex and the network of prisons and ad hoc detention centers that stretches from occupied Ukraine to northern Russia. Taranrog SIZO-2 was described by former prisoners as one of the most notorious and violent sites. Rushchina spent more than 8 months detained there. Rushchina was probably held in a 10 by 16 foot cell with 2 to 4 others and subjected to daily abuse. Yevgeny Markovich, a prisoner of war held at Taranrog, remembers hearing Rushchina speaking to the guards from her cell. She told the prison guards straight to their faces, "You are occupiers. You came into our country. You are murdering our people. I will never cooperate with you," Markovich said. She was probably saved by the fact that she was a woman. If I had said something like that, they would have killed me on the spot. Mikhailo Chaplia, a 37-year-old former POW who spent 2 years at Taranrog, described seeing guards torture prisoners to the edge of their physical limits. But he said he fears with Victoria, they went too far. Rushchina was something of a lone wolf, colleagues said, a fearless, often obstinate reporter who pursued the kind of assignments that made others blanch. After the Russian invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, she was one of the only Ukrainian journalists to report from Russian-occupied territories, first for an online outlet, Hromadsky, where she had been a court reporter, and then as a freelancer, mostly for Ukrainska Pravda. Rushchina began documenting Russian military incursions in southeast Ukraine's Zaporizhia region, including in the city of Enerhodar, the site of Europe's largest nuclear power plant. On March 5th, she and her driver came under fire as they passed within sight of Russian tanks, according to an alert from a press safety monitor, and quickly abandoned their vehicle. Russian soldiers destroyed it, stealing her laptop and camera, while she hid for hours in a nearby building. Still, Rushchina published a March 11th report documenting Enerhodar's resilience, even as the Russian occupation of the city threatened her ability to leave. Days later, Rushchina was stopped at a checkpoint on the outskirts of Berdyansk. Rushchina was released after spending nearly a week in Russian detention, according to a statement by her editors at Hromadsky. She said that before agreeing to release her, the prison guards filmed her reading a prepared statement that credited Russian soldiers with saving her life. Hromadsky terminated Rushchina's contract shortly after the incident in Berdyansk. She had told her employer she wouldn't stop reporting from the occupied territories, despite risks that her editors found unacceptable, according to two former colleagues. One colleague called her decision to return suicide. An editor later said Ruschina had described it as her mission. Ruschina continued to travel across the region, returning to Enerhodar to document a tense military standoff at a nuclear power plant and to cover Russia's gunpoint referendum as it announced its illegal annexation of southern Ukraine's Kherson region. As the months wore on, Ruschina wrote about intelligence operatives and mercenaries fueling Russia's war. In her articles, she also named several Russian officials allegedly responsible for thousands of child abductions in the occupied territories and documented involvement of Russia's Federal Security Service, the FSB, in the arbitrary detention and torture of workers at the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. Mid-2023, Ruschina pitched a new trip to the occupied territories. Her editor at Ukrainska Pravda, Sevgil Musaeva, recalls a June text message about her reporting plans, which included looking into Russia's shadowy network of prisons. Ruschina said she had unearthed new leads identifying FSB operatives involved with detention and torture facilities in Enerhodar, as well as those responsible for the deaths of two teenagers in Burjansk. Records show that Ruschina embarked on a circuitous journey into the occupied territories the following month, first crossing into Poland, and then traveling on to Latvia by bus, and eventually into Russia on July 6, 2023. She was traveling on a Ukrainian passport when she entered the Russian Federation, according to her border documents. Given her profile as a journalist, Ruschina's ability to enter and travel through Russia remains a mystery. Even her editor said she did not understand how Ruschina was not stopped. 8 days after crossing into Russia and continuing on to the occupied territories, Ruschina was picked up by Russian authorities in Enerhodar, according to a friend. She was quickly transferred from Enerhodar to a makeshift detention site in Melitopol, apparently in an area known as the Garages, Ruschina later told a cellmate. When Ruschina emerged from Melitopol for transfer to Taganrog, she looked to have endured severe physical abuse. Her body was heavily bruised from beatings, and there was a knife wound on her arm and another one on her leg. The cellmate recalls Ruschina arriving at Taganrog in December 2023 in testimony provided to the Prosecutor General's office in Kyiv. Six former detainees recalled a consistent sequence of events once they entered the prison gates. "We were immediately thrown into a building," said Inha Chikinda, 42, who had been a soldier in a Ukrainian grenade launcher unit. A group of Russian officers asked questions about the prisoners' names and occupations. Guards beat the prisoners with batons and wooden mallets as they were processed, former prisoners said. Serhiy Taranuk recalled that people just crawled into a cell. Although male and female prisoners were separated into different cells, there seemed to be little division between where POWs and civilians were kept within the complex. Taraniuk recalled temporarily living on the same block as five female medics from Mariupol. "They would beat them in the corridor outside the door," Taraniuk said. "I just heard their screams." Any indication of Ukrainian patriotism became an invitation for abuse, including speaking Ukrainian, having pro-Ukraine tattoos, or refusing to acknowledge Russia's annexation of Crimea, Chaplia said. He remembers overhearing beatings that became so intense that prisoners were ready to change their citizenship to Russian. Taraniuk said interrogation sessions were administered by a group of masked Russian officers who used handcuffs, stun guns, and batons to extract forced confessions. Detainees who resisted were subjected to additional abuse, included beatings while suspended from gymnasium-style bars. Prisoners said they were electrocuted with various devices. Yelisaveta Shrilik, a retired Ukrainian army officer, also held at Taganrog, believes that shocks given to her while in an electric chair were carefully calibrated. They gave me 380 volts because it could not kill me, she said, recalling comments made by the guards. Former prisoners said forced nudity, sexual humiliation, and threats of rape were also part of the interrogation experience. One civilian woman described being seated on a stool in view of 20 or so Russian interrogators and guards, while a male prisoner, naked and bound, was forced to lean into her. She said the onlookers beat and mocked them both. I could have forgotten my own name in that moment, she said. Julian Pilipai, a 30-year-old former Marine, recalled overhearing Russian prison guards discussing a guy who died during interrogations. Chaplia said he sometimes heard limp bodies slapping against the stone floor as Russian guards dragged them along the corridor. Some prisoners took their own lives. They were people who could not take it, Taraniuk said. They hanged themselves on the prison cell bars. In April 2024, after nearly 8 months without news, Roschina's father received word that his daughter was being held in Taranrog. Soon after, Russian authorities and the International Committee of the Red Cross confirmed that Roschina had been detained. Roschina went on a hunger strike in June, according to a former detainee's deposition of Ukrainian prosecutors. The same person told prosecutors that Roschina was sent to an off-site hospital in July as her weight dropped and her physical health deteriorated. Roschina was isolated in a separate cell within earshot of the others when she returned. At the end of August, Roschina's father received a 4-minute phone call from his daughter. According to Igavina Kapalinka, the family lawyer, I asked, how are you? Where are you? She did not answer these questions, Victoria's father told reporters. He said they spoke in Russian, with a male officer present on the line. The father had been told by officials to persuade Vika to eat so that she would not starve. Roschin said his daughter agreed to keep eating and told her parents that she would be home in September. Vika said that she missed us, her father recalled. Meanwhile, editor Museva said one of her sources said the journalist would be included in a September 13th prisoner release. When Roschina did not appear among the released prisoners, Museva said, I didn't sleep for 3 days. On October 10th, Museva got a call from Roschina's father. He'd received a letter from the Russian authorities stating that his daughter was dead. For a month, Roschina's father refused to accept the news. He sent inquiries to Russian authorities requesting investigations into her whereabouts and treatment. In form letters, his requests were denied. A version of this story originally appeared in The Washington Post. Got one of the obituaries for you. The comic actress who packed a wallop, Ruth Buzzy, 1936-2025. Ruth Buzzy thwacked her way to a comedy stardom as the frumpy, paranoid Gladys Ormsby on the NBC sketch show Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In. She was swathed in dowdy brown clothes, her hair parted severely down the center, and a hairnet knotted at her forehead. A woman with no patience for lecherous men, Gladys was both a joke and a feminist symbol, clutching her purse as a weapon to swat any cad who got too fresh. Buzzy played plenty of other characters during her 1968-73 Laugh-In run, earning a Golden Globe Award and 5 Emmy nominations. But Gladys was the most popular, and Buzzy appeared in that persona in other variety and talk shows as well, with the handbag. It looked vicious, but it was just a felt purse lined and filled with old pantyhose and cotton, she said. I was able to swing it with all my might, and it still wouldn't hurt anyone. although it sounded great with a thud when it landed. Raised in Connecticut, Buzzy was the daughter of renowned Swiss sculptor. Though she was head cheerleader in her high school, she struggled in ballet class, said the Hollywood Reporter. Her teacher suggested making the dance comical, and it was a big hit, she said. I continued to do funny dances and funny this and funny that. After graduation, she boldly moved across the country to enroll at the Pasadena Playhouse, studying alongside Dustin Hoffman and Gene Hackman. Playing clumsy housekeeper Agnes Gooch in the play Auntie Mame inspired her to experiment with slumping posture and bad hair, the beginnings of what would become Gladys. After making her Broadway debut in 1966, Sweet Charity, she found her niche as an absurd outsider, starting with a role on ABC's That Girl. Yet she wouldn't be typecast. Her restless creativity had her taking roles all over, said the Washington Post. In off-Broadway shows, movies like 1976's Freaky Friday, sitcoms, and commercials. She even had a recurring role on Sesame Street in the 1990s as shopkeeper Ruthie. She only fully retired in 2021 to spend time on her Texas ranch. Nothing in her career, however, had the enduring appeal of her determinedly unappealing Gladys, said the New York Times. So many people ask me to hit them with my purse, even Elton John, she said in 2016. He immediately made his way over to me and said, "For God's sake, Ruth, please hit me with your purse. That's been on my bucket list for years." Here's a business column I'd like to read for you. Icons, Buffett's surprise retirement. There will never be another Warren Buffett, said Jason Zweig in the Wall Street Journal. The Oracle of Omaha, who announced last week that he will step down as chief executive of Berkshire Hathaway at the end of the year, didn't merely succeed. He succeeded over one of the longest career spans any investor has ever had. If you had invested $1,000 in Berkshire when Buffett took control in 1965, you would have $55 million today. So far as I know, no one in history has beaten the market by so wide a margin over a period of six decades. Buffett, 94, is lionized by investors for finding prized fish where no one else was even looking, and he pored over corporate reports the way most people listen to music. But many of his biggest successes, like investing in Coca-Cola in 1988, American Express in 1991, and Apple in 2016, weren't diamonds in the rough. Anyone else could have made the same bets. He simply considered the quality of the companies, including the integrity of their leadership. Name another celebrated investor today who sticks to such simple principles. Buffett always stood out on Wall Street, said Roger Lowenstein in the New York Times, partly because he wasn't there. When he was recruited to rescue Solomon Brothers in 1991, most people took him for a hayseed. His response was to answer questions in the manner of a fellow who had never met a lawyer. This honesty and Cornhusker simplicity remained true to his character. He capped his salary at $100,000, never took a stock option, kept the same flip phone for decades, lived in the same simple house in Omaha, ate cheeseburgers, and drank Coke. In times of difficulty, Buffett's unwavering optimism in America seemed like a capitalist version of a national security blanket. His biggest contribution may have been to demystify the markets for millions of investors, said Nir Kaiser in Bloomberg. He was never pretended to be omniscient, nor does one need a fancy Wall Street address to be a great investor. All you need is a willingness to do the tedious work of carefully evaluating investments and the courage to act on that effort. Buffett still hasn't lost a step, said Hank Tucker in Forbes. Berkshire stock, which slipped on Buffett's bombshell announcement, is still up 14% this year against a 4% drop for the S&P 500. It is sitting on $347 billion in cash, which has raised speculation about why Buffett has been selling stocks. At his last annual shareholders meeting, he made his opposition to the Trump administration's approach clear, saying trade should not be used as a weapon. But his primary concern about the direction of the country is the threat of runaway inflation and a weakening currency. Buffett has left his successor, Greg Abel, with big loafers to fill, said The Economist. Abel has been with the company for 25 years, and no one expects him to be an investing oracle. But Abel will need to figure out what to do with its enormous cash pile. A downturn is historically when Buffett was ready to pounce. We'll see if Abel has the same perfect timing and eye for value. And with just about a minute left, we'll take a look at the poll watch. 37% of adults believe that real estate is the best long-term investment amid market turmoil, followed by 23% who favor gold, 4% prefer cryptocurrency, 26% of households making less than $50,000 a year are invested in the stock market, compared with 86% with incomes over $100,000. 52% of Americans believe crimes like those committed by the Nazis could take place in the U.S. in their lifetime. And we'll finish out the show with a short quote from, let's see, where did it go? Oh, St. Francis of Assisi, quoted in the Oak Park, Illinois Wednesday Journal, who says, "Preach the gospel at all times. If necessary, use words." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.